Hi, it's Robin with Tributaries. Today we're going to give a listen to the 20th century American healer, mystic, lecturer, and founder of the Infinite Way, Joel Goldsmith. Thanks for tuning in.
Good evening. Surely I must never forget my politeness. Now, these are excerpts from the Los Angeles class of 1962, especially from Reel 5 of this last class that we had here in Los Angeles. You cannot heal spiritually through the human mind, no matter how much knowledge you have. It is not a healer, never can be. You can do some mental healing with the human mind, but that is not in the nature of spiritual healing. It is changing one physical condition into another physical condition. It does not bring about a change of consciousness that results in permanent harmony. Spiritual healing is accomplished when some measure is attained of that mind that was in Christ Jesus, or spiritual consciousness. When you attain it, you are in the fourth dimension of life, and you can heal. The human mind is made up of two powers and is always trying to use the power of good to overcome the power of evil. There is no healing in such a consciousness. And you see what you're doing? You're making a reality of the evil, trying to get rid of it. Have you all? Even in a measure, reveals that evil is not a power. To the human mind, evil not only is a power, but it's a far greater power than nothing. Because there's much more evil in the world, much more sin, much more disease, much more death than there is good. And that is the nature of human experience. But with the first touch of the Spirit, it becomes apparent to you that God is all. Spirit is all. And with that vision, you can see the illusory nature of whatever the appearance may be. The Master did not battle error in any form. He recognized its nothingness. Now you have the proof of that in the New Testament. So the crippled man, pick up thy bed and walk. What did hinder thee? To the blind man, open thine eyes. No battling of error, just a recognition of its non-power. This belief in two powers is a part of the humanhood that has to be overcome. For centuries, people have been trying to use the power of good to overcome the power of evil, and the errors of this world keep increasing. Just as you have seen it, that in the beginning, people fought their wars with sticks, with knives. But as soon as someone had a gun, the other fellow had to lose. As soon as someone had a cannon, the man who only had the gun had to lose. The moment someone had a bomb, the man who only had a cannon had to lose. In other words, this whole of human life is gaining power. And the moment I gain more power than you have to give me whatever it is I want of you. Why? I have more power than you, and you're sitting there believing in the power of power. Now, you could thwart that. You could stop it the way Jesus stopped Pilate, the way Jesus stopped disease. You can stop that by just sitting quietly and saying, oh, no, thou hast no power. Now go ahead and try to use it. And you would find then that evil is not a power. Three times in the history of the world, revelation has been given regarding the nature of evil. The revelation that was given to Gautama Buddha was this is all illusion, not reality. And he immediately began a healing ministry, not based on having God do something to disease, but based on the awareness that if you can see, taste, touch, hear, or feel it, it is to be recognized for its illusory nature. 500 years later, Christ Jesus came to the identical awakening. Resist not evil. It isn't power. The battling of it perpetuates it. Put up thy sword. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. And those who live by the mental sword will die by the mental sword. Do not try to mentally reach out and heal somebody. Because only in the degree that you can say what did hinder you, can you be a spiritual healer. The moment you concern yourself with healing somebody or changing their condition of mind, body, or pocketbook, you are in the dream with them, and it is then the blind leading the blind. Remember, you may call and say that it is grip or flu. You may say that it is unemployment. You may say that it is unhappiness in the home. And you are presenting an appearance to me, which I recognize to be illusory because those conditions have no power to sustain themselves. There's no law to them. If they had a law, they couldn't be healed. So being without law, they are without power, without presence. And if I can maintain that in my consciousness, sooner or later you will acknowledge your freedom. So it is. There are two major revelations in the message of the Infinite Way that absolutely agree with the revelation of the Buddha and Christ Jesus that were given to me long before I knew their writings. Evil, error, in any form, has its rise in an impersonal source. And that impersonal source is the universal belief in two powers. That's not your belief. This is a universal belief that dates back to the mythical name of Adam and Eve. But actually, it is a universal belief, and it is not yours. If I were to try to take from you the belief in two powers, I would fail. But if I realize the universal nature of the belief in two powers, and you have reached out to me, you become free. You lose evil out of your life in proportion as you rise to a place in consciousness where you recognize that God is spirit, and that spirit alone is power, that there is no power aside from spirit. Not that there isn't a claim of material and mental power in the human world, but remember, you can't change that until you get above the material and mental levels into the spiritual. And it is here that you recognize the illusory nature of so-called powers. This world is the temple of God. The illusion is in our sense of this world. The world itself isn't an illusion. Some of the Oriental teachings claim it is. And look at them. And you'll see what's happened to them. Because they accept this world as an illusion. But you see, it is impossible to create an illusion. All you can create of an illusory nature is a mental image and thought. God never created an illusion, and God did create a world. It is a world that we, in our human sense, see through a glass darkly. If only we could see it face to face, this very universe would be the temple of God, as your individual body would be. Your individual body is the temple of God, and you are seeing it through the universal belief in two powers. Therefore, The sooner you come to some measure of realization of one power, the sooner does your body begin to respond. As you learn this principle of the infinite way, you will disregard appearances, knowing that you are witnessing these appearances through the illusory sense, the belief in two powers. You can't enter this Christ consciousness while you are trying to change appearances. You are still in the human mind taking up the mental sword. All of our infinite way work is the very opposite of that which is taught in the metaphysical movements. We do not agree with any one of the metaphysical movements in our major premises. We do not agree that mind is God. We do not agree that there is any error in the thought of the patient that needs to be uncovered. We work entirely from the standpoint that all evil, regardless of its name or nature, is impersonal and has its source in a universal belief in two powers. And it is for this reason that we never take the name of the patient into our treatment. We never take the name of the disease in our treatment. This is folly, because we are not dealing with people or diseases. We are dealing with a, if you want to call it, a mortal illusion, a universal illusion, an Adamic dream, the carnal mind. Call it what you will. In the end, it has to be recognized as non-power. To be able to heal through the message of the infinite way, you must first of all understand God, and that God appears as men and women. Therefore, we are the manifestation of all that God is. We are God in expression. We do not express God. God expresses himself as you. God is doing the expressing, not you. You do not express God. You do not have that ability. God alone expresses God. God expresses himself as you. But it's God doing the expressing. God is living. You are not living God's life, and you're not thinking God's thoughts. God is thinking God's thoughts through you if you are receptive. God is living his life through you if you stop taking thought for your own life. This is the truth of our being. Any appearance to the contrary is based on the universal belief in two powers, entirely impersonal, and because it was not created by God, it has no power, no law to sustain it. You are now impersonalizing and nothingizing. And that takes you back to the work of 1959. And if you will review any of the tapes of the year 1959, you will see that in all of them, this lesson was made clear. With almost all of the ills of mankind, you will find that our work will bring forth almost 80% of very quick healings for this reason. It recognizes the impersonal nature and then dispels it. The other claims that last longer have been absorbed into our consciousness personally. For one reason or another, we have hugged the particular beliefs to us that do not readily yield. In other words, many people, the moment they pass 70, begin to accept the 70 years and 10. They apply it to themselves, they begin to fear it or hate it, and the first thing you know, they've got it. And other people have been brought up to fear poverty. And they live so in that fear of poverty that they end up having it. And so it is that very many errors, we personalize ourselves. We fear cancer or we fear heart disease. Why? Because we hear so much about them. And in that way, we hug them to ourselves and we give a practitioner an awfully hard time to free us. Whereas with most of our claims, 80% of them, we don't only don't want any part of them, but we aren't fearing them. And as long as we don't love them or hate them or fear them, the practitioner can have an easy time with it. There has risen such a world fear of these that long before we get them, we are fearing them. So what we are doing is preparing soil for them to take root in. Then it is more difficult to get them out. There are other things we have hugged to ourselves and made more personal, and by clinging to them have made them more difficult to heal. Except for these, healing in the infinite way should be a very simple thing. It involves entirely the ability not to react to appearances, the ability to realize I am not dealing with a condition that has to be fought or overcome. The master said, why call thou me good? He was just being. The human cannot be spiritual. The human cannot be God or Christ. But in proportion as the human being dies, Christhood is more and more revealed, more to the onlooker than to the individual. That is true. You will find this, and probably it explains why a mystic can't claim to be a mystic. Do you not see that in the moment that I have experienced the Christ, I have beheld perfection, and that from that moment on I'm comparing myself with it? And do you see how unworthy I must become in my own eyes? Even while you out here say, oh, he has improved, oh, he is a better man, oh, she is a finer woman, the individual themselves can't feel that, because they're always measuring themselves against the perfection they've experienced. And they know how far from that they can come. And so Jesus could say, why callest thou me good? Oh no, man walking the earth can't quite say, I am Christ. That really is sinful. But Christ is my identity. That's quite another matter. And forgetting my past sins, I'm looking forward to attaining the realization of that Christhood. If you hear within you, thou art my son in whom I am well pleased, be still and know that I am God, you are hearing aright. That gives you no privilege to say these words, because in the saying of them, you reverse the meaning. The moment you say that you are Christ, you've lost it. It is only when you hear the still small voice say it that you are hearing truth. We are trying to immortalize a human being when we say, I am Christ, I am Spirit, I am God. And that's a lie. You only have to look in the mirror to find out that you're lying. But when that still voice says to me, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, even though that person may at the moment appear to be dying or in dire sin, I know that God has spoken to me and revealed their true identity. And then there must come a healing. The ideal way of living is where you can be in this world but not of it, where you can perform all the functions of your business, art, or profession and still not be in it. No one should believe that the spiritual life is intended to set them apart in a monastery or convent. The function of the spiritual life is to bring your spiritual influence into this world. Yes, go up to the mountaintop for 40 days and nights and be inspired of God, but then come down into the plains and by the seaside and heal the sick and forgive the sinners and raise the dead, feed the hungry. That really is the function of this work, to enable us individually to rise so high in consciousness that we recognize God as the central theme of this universe and all evil as merely the impersonal belief in two powers and thereby nothingize it. You remember what a wonderful night that was in Claire? And that was the reason. In the beginning, God. And God sent himself forth into expression as man. God the Father appeared individually as God the Son. Now you can understand that if you think of the sun in the sky and then think of the sunbeams, you can begin to see that the sun, the great big universal whole sun, is now manifesting itself as sunbeams. But each sunbeam is made up of all that the sun is made up of: light, warmth, whatever else there is to sun. So you can see that God, the infinite, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, God sends himself forth as the sun. The individual you and me, but it's still God. Only the individual has all of the qualities of the Father. Son, all that I have is thine. And here the sun in the sky is saying to the sunbeam, sunbeam, you have all that I have. You have the light that I am, and you have the warmth that I am. We are one. And so God says, I am God the Father, you are God the Son. All that I have is thine. All of my qualities are your qualities. My life is your life. You have no life of your own. The only life you are living is my life. You have no mind of your own. The only mind you have is my mind. You have no soul of your own. The only soul you have is my soul. I am God the Father, you are God the Son, and we are really one. All that I have is thine. I have manifested myself on earth as you. Now this is in the beginning, and this is our spiritual identity. This is our true selfhood. And this is what you are, this is what I am now, in this very moment. But somewhere along the line, there arose a mist. That's one way of putting it. Or Adam and Eve sinned. That's another way of putting it. Or man fell. That's another way of putting it. All it means, however, is that all of a sudden, we forgot our identity, our Father, and we looked in the mirror, or we looked in the lake or the river, and saw a reflection and said, oh, that's me. And we thought that was all there is to us, forgetting that what we were seeing is only the body, the form. But there was more to us than body and form. But no, we only saw the body and form, and so we became an animal. A man with animal instincts, a woman with animal instincts. We've been working up through the centuries towards civilization. But the point remains that for the most part, we have just been animal humans becoming human humans. Bad humans becoming good humans. Imperialistic humans becoming democratic or republican humans. But only the few have made the jump out of mortality into immortality. Only a few have had the vision to see that whether I'm a bad human or a good human, I'm still a human. And as long as I'm a human, the good one can become bad and the bad can become good, but I'm still human. And it is only when enough light reaches your consciousness so that you can begin to perceive what the Master meant when he said, "My kingdom is not of this world. I have a meat that ye know not of." Now what is he talking about? When you begin to question the Master, what did he mean by "my grace, my peace, my kingdom, I have meat the world knows not of"? What is this teacher talking about? And then, through questioning, through seeking, through bringing yourself into the atmosphere of those who have attained some measure of that wisdom, or their writings, all of a sudden, a sentence here, a sentence there, will awaken something in you. And all of a sudden you perceive there is a hidden manna. Ah, now we're getting somewhere. We're getting on the path of withinness. We're getting on the path of the inner kingdom. As we continue, eventually, like Paul, you get to a place where you say, "Oh, there is something more to me than me. There is a presence, I feel it. Sometimes it talks to me. Sometimes it just directs me or leads me, points the way in which I'm to go. I'm aware now of something else in my life. There's me, oh yes, but there's something else too. I become aware of some good coming into my experience that I didn't earn or deserve or prove worthy of. It just came by some grace. In many different ways, I begin to see there is something. There is something. And in time, it begins to impart itself to me, and I recognize what Paul did. I live, yet not I. It's really this presence in me that is living my life. It is this presence in me that goes before me to make the crooked places straight. By the time I get there looking for trouble, the trouble's all gone. By the time I get to the place where I thought my supply would run out, I find a fresh supply. Just by the time I thought I didn't have any friends, I'd make a new one. Something is going before me and doing funny things in my life. Doors are opening that were closed. People are appearing with a different opinion of me, a different thought of me. Something's happening. I'm aware now a presence goes before me to make the crooked places straight, or a presence goes with me and protects me. It may be in my car driving. It may be anywhere. But all of a sudden, I have the assurance, "Fear not. Fear not, I am with you." And I find that it's true. No matter what the danger is, it passes. No matter what the discord is, it passes. No matter what the misunderstanding is, it passes. I'm aware now. Well, Scripture says, "He that is within me is greater than he that is in the world." Now I'm commencing to be aware there is a He within me. Whether Jesus calls it the Father within, or whether Paul calls it the Christ indwelling, I don't care about names. I know now there is a something, a presence. It does wonderful, wonderful things for me. And in proportion as I relax, taking thought for my own life, in proportion as I stop fearing, in that proportion does this presence take over more and more, until the day comes when you may say, "Well, can I give you something? Can I lend you something? Can I do something for you?" And then I answer, "Oh, I have meat. Oh, I have all that's necessary. Yes, because now I have the understanding that I and my Father are one, and all the Father hath is mine. And from that moment, my gaze is taken from the outer world, and I'm no longer dependent on man whose breath is in his nostril. Now, I may have to prove this. I may have to prove a period of lack and limitation in which every human door shuts itself in my face. And I'm going to tell you that it happened to me, too. Every human door was shut. Every human avenue of supply was closed. And there I was. And believe me, there I was also. But it was in that period, that the realization was given to me. The realization of this presence, this I and my Father are one. Here where I stand, even in this lack and limitation, here where I stand, I and the Father are one, and it broke the spell. And probably up to that time, in the back of my consciousness, I was sort of blaming other people that they weren't being a little more generous or weren't doing things for me that they might have done and didn't. But at that moment, the spell was broken, and I was able inwardly to say, keep everything you've got. No longer do I need anything that any man has. I and my Father are one, and mine is an unfolding good from within. And it still was very, very tough, because the conditions didn't change in a day, but within a few days they began to change, but so gradually, so minutely, but also so positively. And from then on, it was a gradual thing, but a steady upward going, a steady onward going, but always without looking to man whose breath is in his nostril. Always without asking, always with the ability to rest back here inside in the realization I and my Father are one. The I of my being is this incarnate Christ, the Son of God, and it is my meat and my wine and my water. So it has been, and so I have witnessed with students from that day to this, that the moment they began the life of withinness, which can only begin when you recognize that there is this presence within you, closer to you than breathing, and then begin to withdraw your attention from the outer realm, and more depend. Now, that doesn't mean that you become fanatical in your outside life. It doesn't mean that you throw up your job and sit on a park bench and wait to be supported. No, you go about your business or your art or your profession the same as you always have, only with the realization that you are serving, you are not expecting. You are giving or sharing, you're not asking. Let me put it another way. The appearance says that some form of justice or recognition is being withheld from you. And of course you're looking to someone, maybe a judge on a bench that's to hand out justice, or it may be some friend or relative. And of course you're looking to them to express justice, and of course you're going to look in vain, because it isn't going to happen that way. Almost any lawyer will tell you not to go into court expecting justice. Settle your case before it gets to court. It's a safe policy to pursue. But if you must go to court, don't look to the judge for it or the jury. Go through the motions that are expected, but realize the only place justice can come from is from within yourself. Nobody can give you justice, and no one can withhold justice from you, because it is a part of your own Christhood. It is the meat that you have that the world knows nothing of. Justice is a quality and an activity of your consciousness, and it doesn't come to you from anyone. It flows out from you to the world. Perhaps you believe someone owes you something. This is one of the greatest material mistakes in the world. It has led up to this belief that the government owes us a living. None of that is true. Nobody owes us anything because we have been Christed. God has incarnated his Son, Christ, within us. And this is our meat, our wine, our water. We are to draw from the invisible source. We are to draw from our hidden manna. It makes a difference whether it's money, recognition, reward, justice. There's a question here about I have friends who regard it as unethical to charge for healing work. No, there's nothing unethical about it at all. Eventually, it shouldn't be necessary to charge for healing work. None of us in the infinite way charge for any healing work. Whatever comes to us comes voluntarily. I don't know of any of our practitioners who charge, who send out bills, who keep accounts, except government accounts of income and expenses, but not accounts of what a patient owes or doesn't owe. No, eventually, when the practitioner has attained the consciousness that I and my Father are one, all that the Father hath is mine, I have an invisible meat. There isn't any need to charge, no need whatsoever to charge, because all that we need comes in, and it comes in one way or another, sometimes through our practice and sometimes not, or sometimes part of it, sometimes all of it. It'll come, but we must attain that consciousness of our union with God. Eventually, there will be no need to charge for anything. Now, don't take that in a wrong light either. It will probably always be necessary for merchants to put a price on their merchandise. You and I can't come along and guess how much it costs to build an automobile and then volunteer to give what we think it should be. Or a suit of clothes. No, I don't mean that. And I don't believe the time will come when our publishers will permit books to be on our table without a price tag on them. I don't think that. But in our personal experience, in our healing work, in our teaching work, the day will come when there'll be no need for charges, and there wouldn't be a need now if all of those who came to our work were far enough along on the spiritual path. Then there would be no need. It is only at the stage where the public is still coming to us, those who have not yet ascended in the understanding of the nature of supply, of sharing, of gratitude, that there is still a need in some departments of work for specific charges. But one thing is certain, that we have been demonstrating for 30 years that it is not necessary to make charges for healing work. And while it is true that many, many people never think of paying for spiritual help, many people do think of paying, and sometimes it won't cover your postage, what they think of paying. That's true, but you always know that it is those who have not yet come into any sense of the spiritual life. They don't know what they're getting, therefore they don't know what to give in exchange for it. The spiritual has no value in their experience. As a matter of fact, those who have spiritual light are more than generous in their sharing, and for a very good reason. How would a person, except the few who happen to be fortunately or sometimes unfortunately born to wealth, except those few, how could a person devote their lives to this work and remain 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, living in the spirit if they had to go out and battle this world in competition and then come home and set up a healing ministry and do as many of us do, have to be awake most of the night with telephone calls and cables? It just couldn't be. But you see, as soon as an individual receives the first measure of healing and the first degree of spiritual light opens in them, the first thing they want to do is share, because they know the value of what they have received. So it goes in every walk of life. A practitioner, a teacher in this work, who really has been touched, knows that they are not in business. They are functioning only as an instrument to bring forth on earth the activity of God's grace. Now, the activity of God's grace doesn't appear on earth except through an individual's consciousness. In other words, God's grace was on this earth before Jesus was, and he acknowledged it. Christ was before Abraham. But of what avail was it to the sick people? Until that individual came along with the Christ consciousness, the healing consciousness, divine grace, was inoperative. What good was it to the sinners to know that there was a God? None, until there was an individual who could be an inlet and an outlet to God's forgiving grace. What good would it do the people who were hungry until an individual comes along who knows how to multiply? In other words, all of the experience of God on earth must come as individual consciousness. When a practitioner or teacher knows this, they know that they are no longer living their own lives. They don't have to support themselves. Their patients don't have to support them. They have now attained that consciousness that supports them. And it does, and it will. Do you see that at this particular moment, we are at the place where there is a me, a human being, but now consciously aware of an indwelling presence of Christ or Son of God, which is my real identity, even though there is still a part of me not yet experiencing it fully? Do you see where we are? We are at that point, and you should be at that point, where you are acknowledging that there is in you, that God has incarnated himself in you as the Son of God. God the Father, God the Son is one. And now God the Father is appearing on earth as God the Son, which you are. And that is your inner spiritual identity and integrity and the source of your life, the source of your abundance, the source of your happy relationships. And as long as you draw on it and not on people out here, it will manifest. If you abide in this state of consciousness, eventually an experience happens that has happened to those called mystics. It is an experience where, and usually in meditation, where all of a sudden the spirit is in full play, and for a moment or a minute or an hour, you may lose the awareness of your own identity. Or an experience like this may come up. During the LA class 1962, I had the experience of leaving my body. Please explain this. That is one of those experiences when you become so conscious of yourself as spirit that you lose the awareness of your material form. That happens. There's nothing unusual about it. It happens to students every week of the year, sometimes every day of the week. It can't be induced, so please, nobody try to make it happen, because you can't. You can only defeat your own purpose. It is one of those things that happens by grace. And it happens in some moment when you're absent from the body, that is, unaware of the physical universe. Remember, you have no problems. If you have problems, you're in the physical universe. You're in a state of consciousness where you are free of problems, and that oneness with God can be so acute that all of a sudden you have no sense of your body at all. And then the feeling is that you're out of your body. And sometimes you can look back and see your body. That happens. It's happened to many, many. I know how many of my students it's happened to. But it is not something that can be induced. It is not something that you can take lessons in. It is something that comes in a moment that you think not. In a moment when you are not mentalizing, when you're not trying to be something other than you are, when you're just realizing, oh, thank God, I am what I am. I am, and I'm not going to try to be anything other than what I am. I'm not going to try to be spiritual. I'm not going to try to be Christ. I'm just satisfied. I am what I am. And in that moment, it is very likely that you can have an intense spiritual experience, sometimes to the degree of witnessing yourself free of the body. Now, of course, let's come to this question. How is body to be regarded? As an ex-CS practitioner, I am familiar with the concept of perfect spiritual body, but I'm somewhat confused regarding the infinite way approach to the subject. Now, I and my Father being one, and my Father being spirit, I am spiritual, and therefore my body is spiritual, and my body is the temple of God. What I see with my eyes is not my body, but a universal material concept. In other words, again, there's nothing personal about life. It's impersonal. And so it is on the human plane that I am not seeing my concept of body. I am seeing the universal concept of body, more especially the universal concept of material body. That's what I see with my eyes. And if I were to look out at you with my eyes, I would also see your physical form. What I would really see is the universal concept of you. When, however, and remember, this is the illusion, because that is not what is out there, what I see with the eye. What is out there is the perfect spiritual temple of God. And that's what you are tabernacling in. You never lose your physical body because you haven't got one. You lose your material concept of body, and then you see face to face. When you look in the mirror now, you're seeing through a glass darkly. When your eyes are closed and you are high in spiritual consciousness, you are seeing face to face. You are seeing him as he is, and you'll be perfectly satisfied with that likeness. But remember, you do not see the spiritual form with your eyes. Even if someone of the departed should walk into this room in their ghost-like body, you would still not be seeing their spiritual form. You would still be seeing a material concept, because the ghostly body is just as much a material concept as a material body. It is only when you get to incorporeality, that which is invisible to the eyesight, that you really get to the spiritual temple, not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. And this is the body, which is your indestructible, immortal and eternal body. You do not see it and never will see it with your eyes, but every practitioner at some time or other sees it in their treatment work or meditation work. Every practitioner I have ever known, at least every busy one, has at least once in their life beheld the spiritual body. But most practitioners, those who have gone far in spiritual understanding, it is not an uncommon experience. It is a very usual experience to behold spiritual creation not only as body, but the body of a tree, the body of an ocean, the body of the sky. Because what we behold as nature is also not the world of God's creating. That also is a universal concept of a star body or a moon body or a sun body or a tree body. The reality is incorporeal, invisible, and discernible only to what is called the fourth dimensional or Christ consciousness, and only while in it. Now, I don't know if there ever has been a human being remain in that state of fourth dimensional consciousness. Certainly the Master didn't. Certainly Buddha didn't. I know nothing about John. Paul definitely didn't. So I don't actually believe that anyone has ever remained in that fourth dimensional consciousness while on Earth. Maybe, but certainly I don't know of any records of it. But almost everyone who has had some measure of spiritual illumination catches a glimpse once in a while. And the higher the individual goes in consciousness, the more apt they are to discern the spiritual body and at frequent intervals. It is for this reason the Master went away for 40 days and 40 nights, so that he could be lifted up in consciousness above the evidence of the senses, above the appearances. It is for this reason we have the story of the ascension, which is nothing more or less than rising above the material, visible concepts, rising into the invisible reality. That is why we have the story of Elijah and Elisha. Elisha wants to wear the mantle of the priest. He wants to be a priest. He wants to wear Elijah's robe. And Elijah says, if when I ascend, you see me ascend on a cloud, my mantle will fall upon you. That's absolutely true. In the moment that you can behold the incorporeal Christ, in that moment, the robe of Christhood has fallen upon you. You are now brother or sister to Christ. In that moment that you can behold the Christ. Don't try to do it mentally. You'll fool yourself. It's by grace. When Peter saw Christ appearing as Jesus and said, thou art the Christ, the Master answered, flesh and blood hath not told you this. You didn't learn this through the five physical senses. My Father within you revealed it to you. Spiritual discernment revealed my Christhood to you. And from then on, Peter was a more valuable and probably a more highly honored disciple. Not quite enough to prevent him from falling down in the emergency. But nevertheless, the ability to behold the Christhood of an individual bears witness to the fact that some measure of spiritual discernment has arisen in you. And you can tell whether this is true or not by the degree in which you no longer judge, criticize, condemn, and by the degree in which you can forgive. If it's difficult for you to forgive, if you are still in the stage of not realizing, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. If you're still bearing resentment, desiring revenge, you still have not attained spiritual discernment. Because when you attain spiritual discernment, you will know that regardless of what mistake anyone makes, they're making it out of ignorance of truth and thus no other way. And you can't be mad at them for that. Any more than you can be mad at a child who gets into trouble not knowing any better. When they're old enough to know better, then you can get good and mad at them. But the point is that with spiritual discernment, you can easily see that we are the victims of a mass hypnotism built on what's supposed to be a very clever statement. Self-preservation is the first law of nature. That's the most horrible statement that was ever coined by anyone at any time. Nothing in all of the world touches that in degradation. Because all it means is, I'm out for me. And who cares about you? To save my life, I'll take your life. To save my fortune, I'll take your fortune. That's all it means, self-preservation. I'll get mine even at the expense of yours. That's why it's degraded, and that's why it's mortal, that's why it's human. But with the first touch of spiritual discernment, you can understand the master when he says, not an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. No longer wanting your enemy to be punished. Pray for them, forgive them. Now, when you have reached this, you have reached spiritual discernment. When you can understand that people are only motivated by the hypnotic suggestion that they have to preserve their own life, they have to preserve their own fortune, then you can say, Father, forgive them. Do you remember that postal card? Years ago, they sold an awful lot of them. Two birds talking on a tree to each other. One saying to the other, why are those people down there so worried, so hurried, so angry? The other one says, you know, I don't think they have a God like we have. And it is that way, because with spiritual discernment, you know you have a God. And you know you have it closer than breathing, nearer than hands and feet. And so you have the wisdom not to try to get it by human means, by might or by power, but let it come by grace. I don't know what time it is or where. But are we anywhere? Huh? Please explain the statement, ye are bought with a price. I don't really know it enough to comment on it at this time. Please, if you care, discuss briefly working with teachers on the inner plane. No, that really can't be discussed because it's something that no one can accomplish. That has to be accomplished for one. And there are two levels of it. There is the psychic level, in which there are those sometimes called masters who either died and who reach back to people on this plane of life and become their teachers, guides, usually with false teachings, because they never had ascended above the human estate on earth, and they haven't ascended yet on the other side. And then there is the other level of the contact with spiritual masters, those who have risen above humanhood and who are imparting only spiritual principles. And there you come to the statement, you have not chosen me, I have chosen you. An individual in one way or another, gets to a certain place in consciousness, ripeness, one word for it, spiritual ripeness, where they can be used, and then a contact is made with them. But it's all a matter of grace, and there is much written about it, 99% of which is false. And for the same reason that you can understand that those who actually have the experience are not going to write a book about it. They are not going to share it with the profane. They are not going to cast their pearls before swine. No, they are not going to give a life work for the masses to buy for a dollar or two or three and laugh at or ridicule or perhaps lock them up. No. No, whenever a person attains any kind of true spiritual light, you can bet your bottom dollar they're not sharing it with anyone unless it be their own students. They are not talking about it to anyone else. And they're only talking with their own students at the level of their students' readiness to receive it. They're giving milk to the babes and saving the meat for those who are ready for the meat. And so, for my part, I'm inclined to disregard almost all of the books that have been written on those subjects, except those that have been written from the psychic plane, which evidently are true. Well, just think. Can you imagine? It's come and it's gone. Can't believe it.
For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are in the usual spots, and if not, please do let us know. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.